So my job as a leader in healthcare is to give people the freedom to do that to the best of their abilities, to fix the processes, remove the barriers, and then work on consistency and accountability in the workplace so that every day when caregivers come to work, they know what to expect and they know how to deliver that care. And I, as a leader, am that umbrella that kind of shields them from the noise of the world, from the worries about how we're going to pay our bills, to the worries about where we're going to find the staff, and all those things that we as leaders have to worry about, so that our team members every day can just come to work and focus on the art and science of care delivery.
Welcome to the Health Leader Forge. My name is Mark Bonica, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of New Hampshire.
Today's guest is Darren Rourke, President and Chief Operating Officer of Wentworth Douglas Hospital in Dover, New Hampshire. Darren has had an unusual path, from working in an insurance company to becoming a nurse specialized in emergency medicine and intensive care, to leading large healthcare organizations. His path also took him from Illinois to Florida to Dover, New Hampshire, just one town over from UNH. I really enjoyed hearing Darren's story and learning about his deep commitment to patient care while also incorporating a deep understanding of business. I hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you do, won't you give it a rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you may be listening? Or better yet, share it with a friend. Thanks for listening. And here is Darren Rourke. Welcome to the podcast, Darren.
Thank you, Mark. I'm thrilled to be here.
So looking at your history, you went to North Central College and studied business marketing. But a few short years later, you returned to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to earn your BSN, Bachelor of Science in Nursing. Can you tell me, tell me about that journey? Like, what drew you to marketing? And then what made you change tracks and go back to nursing?
Well, Mark, it really starts off with high school. When I was in high school, I was working as a claims processor. We had a, what they called at the time, a work co-op program.
Okay.
And I got a job when I was 15 after school processing insurance claims for what was at the time Equitable Insurance Company. And so while I was in high school, Equitable was bought by Cigna. And so I was a claims processor at night, processing what they called tier one claims, which were the easy office visits and prescription drug receipts and things of that nature. And I would work 8 hours a day following school, 5 days a week.
Wow.
And I did that for most of my high school years. And then about 6 months before graduation, realized that high school was passing me by and all I was doing was working, and took a break from the insurance company and went to work in retail and waiting tables at the local Pizza Hut just for a change, and started college at a junior college, actually Joliet Junior College in Joliet, Illinois, and did a semester there and realized that I was really bored in college and I wasn't sure what direction I wanted to go with my career and my life. So I went back to the insurance company and was fortunate enough to get a job working in their mailroom, because at the time that was the only thing they had open, but they remembered me from when I worked there in high school. And I spent 3 months in the mailroom and then really had one of those kind of movie moments where the director of the facility, Mr. Andrew Cable, came down to the mailroom and said, "Darren, you've opened your last piece of mail." And I'm like, "Are you kidding me right now?" And the gentleman that ran the mailroom, Carlos, says, "You know, well, who's going to open the mail?" And he goes, "We'll find somebody else, but Darren's coming with me. I have a job for him." And Mr. Cable saw something in me that you know, I didn't see in myself, and took me up to the boardroom and explained that they had a new program that they were going to be doing with the state of Illinois and Cigna and a company called Caremark. And he needed me to dive into the business and learn the business quickly. So I did a stint of working 3 months in every department that existed in the insurance processing area there at Cigna. And then when I was done, I went to work for the as a systems integration person, and my job was to take all those prescription receipts that we used to get at the drugstore, and we would go to this prescription card that everyone uses today that they present at a pharmacy, and Caremark was the first company to roll those out. So the Cigna company was going to transition the state of Illinois account to this card. So anyway, it's a long-winded answer, but basically I was working full-time during the day and going to school at night, and the easiest and marketing seemed like a good fit for what I was doing. And I enjoyed a tremendous amount, you know, of career success.
Wow.
There at Cigna, and went to work for their operation in Texas, and actually then was recruited by Caremark and went to work for Caremark themselves, and enjoyed a great career, but just didn't feel like I was making the world, you know, a better place. And I felt like there was something else I should be doing with my life. And I literally had one of those moments where I, after finishing my degree, just quit the insurance company, came back home to my family in Illinois. And my brother said, you know, you should go volunteer in the emergency room, because you spend your whole life, because I had had some unfortunate illnesses that, you know, had me go to the emergency room. I was electrocuted. And anyway, I just felt like that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do with my life after that moment. When you have a very bad health scare, like I did, it kind of changes your perspective, especially when you're a young person. And I went to volunteer in the emergency room at the, you know, as my brother suggested. And within a couple of weeks, the emergency room director, Pat McShaffrey, came up to me and she said, you know, the team tells me you ask a lot of questions. And I said, yeah, because I was working in triage. My job was to write down all this information when a patient comes in. And some of it didn't make sense, because it didn't matter if the triage nurse was in there with another patient or if she was just sitting there twiddling her thumbs. I always had to do the same thing. And I was like, well, why don't you just take the patient back and start working on them, and I can ask those questions later. I mean, you'd think you would want to get them in. And so she said, well, do you want a job? And I said, I would love a job. So Pat McShaffrey, the director of the emergency room, said, we have a trauma registrar job. And I was like, well, what's that? And she said, well, it's where you take the medical records and you input the information from the medical records into the trauma database that we send to the state, because they were a trauma center. And I said, well, that sounds just like what I did, you know, at the insurance company back in the day.
Right.
I
can do this, you know. You're well trained.
So I took that job because, you know, my dad always told me you never turn down work. And then she brought me into the trauma bay once to watch a resuscitation of a patient. Oh, and man, I watched the team save this person's life much as they had saved mine. And I said, I have to do this job. And I immediately asked the team what I needed to do. And they said, well, you go to school and you become a nursing assistant and you know, and then you'll, you know, you can be a nurse. And I was like, great. So I became a nursing assistant and then looked for schools that had an accelerated program, which University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee did. And it was amazing. I went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, had a great experience with some very enlightening instructors, including Dr. Jacqueline Clinton, who I took an independent study with. And before I even graduated nursing school, I had published my first paper in the Journal of Emergency Nursing called The Need to Increase Organ Donation Among African Americans and Hispanic Americans in Organ Review, because I really was so passionate about organ donation and the things I had witnessed working in the emergency room as an emergency room tech. And I did that. I worked as a tech in the emergency room at Columbia St. Mary's, right across the street from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, while I was going to school, and just had a great experience and loved taking care of people.
Wow. So I've got to ask a couple of questions. So first of all, how'd you get electrocuted? What were you up to?
You know, it's a long story short, but I basically was tending the fireplace at my mom and dad's home, and a log fell out of the fireplace and landed and kind of rolled onto the carpet. And I took the tong things and put the log back in the fireplace, but there was a lot of ashes and soot there. I tried to sweep them up and it didn't work. So I grabbed an electric Bissell broom and plugged it in and vacuumed those hot ashes and soot. And you're not supposed to do that, because that oxygen kind of ignited in the motor caught on fire and the vacuum cleaner short circuited while I was holding on to it.
All right.
Yeah, they put warning labels on shop vacs and things like that now that say do not vacuum, you know, hot ashes and soot into the vacuum cleaner. So
can we credit you with that?
Yeah.
Credit you with that innovation. All right. And I got to ask, you were working 8 hours a day in high school. Like, where does that work ethic come from?
You know, it comes from my family. My dad, it was a, you know, kind of a hardworking Irish man, and you know, you never turned down work, and he would work 2 to 3 jobs to provide for the family. He was a very blue collar man, and He always told me and my brothers that we were going to do something different with our lives. We were going to work with our minds, not our hands and our bodies. And he was going to see to it that we had those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so it's been embedded in me since I was really young that you do the same thing. You follow in those footsteps. So nice. I've always, worked multiple jobs and never been afraid to shy away from long hours and hard work.
Well, that seems to have served you pretty well. So you graduate with your BSN, and so now I hear you've been engaged with emergency medicine even before you go back to study nursing, and your first, it looks like your first job maybe was at Carle Foundation Hospital as an RN, and you were working in intensive care almost immediately. It looks like is that accurate?
Yeah, I graduated nursing school and went to work at Carle in the trauma ICU in a nurse residency program. And it was a great experience taking care of some of the sickest people you could possibly imagine in a trauma ICU, and very fulfilling work. And it was just an amazing experience. And I loved being at the bedside caring for my patients. It was amazing.
So that strikes me as kind of, I'm not a nurse by training, but I've been around that a lot in my career. Not typical, isn't it? It's not typical to see a brand new nurse in that level of intensity of care.
Certainly not back in, 1999, 2000, when I graduated nursing school. These days, due to the nursing shortage, we've been a little bit more creative with those programs and we'll provide a lot more of education and background. And we do see new graduates going into places like the emergency room or even the ICU. But you're correct. Back then, that was a rare thing. As a matter of fact, when I graduated from nursing school, there was not a nursing shortage. There were many people from my class who couldn't find jobs as a nurse,
oh, wow,
believe it or not. And I know that, amazing how things change, but it's very cyclical. You always see what goes around seems to come back around. And so I was very fortunate and blessed to have found that job. I would say the people that I interviewed with saw something in me and gave me that opportunity. And that's really been my career. I've always encountered mentors and people who really have identified things in myself that I didn't see and have given me opportunities to excel and try new things. And it's and I've never hesitated to take on those opportunities and challenges.
I'm going to kind of foreshadow the rest of our conversation here or a significant portion of our conversation here by saying, like, critical care emergency services seems to be your kind of the thing that at least up till relatively recently was like your thing. So you had some exposure even before you went back, but like, what is it about that field, that part of the field that really, drew you and kept you going back over and over again?
It was the challenge. Working in like the emergency room, you never know how many patients you're going to see every day. You never know how sick they're going to be. So I really, really thrived on the fact that no 2 days were ever the same and everything was different. And I loved the immediate impact that you had, especially in the emergency room when you would save someone's life or when you would have the opportunity to participate in a resuscitation and being able to get like an acute STEMI patient to the cath lab immediately so the cath lab team can take over and bring them back to life, and being able to identify what exactly is wrong with the patient and what do they need. And that I've always... I loved those puzzle pieces, because when a patient comes into the emergency room, they have a complaint, and then you have to literally kind of analyze that complaint, assess that patient, and then arrive at what is really ailing them. And as an emergency room nurse, you work right alongside your medical staff to do that. You're the first person that sees that patient, and being able to recognize what's going on and then go to the physician like I have, in my career. And nurses do this, they identify this, they run and get the doctor and they say, look, I think this patient's having a STEMI, or I think this patient's got a bleed, or I think, this is what's going on. I think I have a stroke. And then assembling that medical team and coming together and saving that life, and the adrenaline that you get from that it's addictive. You just have such an impact, and you go home every day and you're like, wow, I made a difference in someone's life. I really did. And it's so fulfilling. And there's no feeling like that any other career, really gives you, when you know you had the moment to really impact and change someone's life for the better. And I guess that with me knowing what I went through, with my experience, being able to give that back to others and pay that forward has always been my driving force.
Well, that's really neat. So one of the things I like to ask when I talk to clinicians is about their kind of, as they transition to practice, when did you feel like you developed your clinician identity? So when did you feel like, you know, you look in the mirror and you're like, I'm a nurse. I'm a fully formed clinician. Was it when you passed your exams, when you graduated from school, before, after? How did it kind of come to you? When were you comfortable with that identity?
You know, I would say early on, you know, working as a tech in the emergency room, you know, you get a lot of really great experiences. And I had the opportunity to learn a great deal from everyone that I've ever worked with, you know, in the various hospitals that I've been able to work. And I would say working at Carle in, you know, in the ICU was really one of those moments where you really feel like you found your nursing identity. I can say that there was one time when the ICU was slow and they floated me down to a med surg floor to take care of patients in the med surg unit, which didn't happen very often, but it was stay home or come in and work in med surg. And I'm like, yeah, I'll go work in med surg because, you know, I have that worker mentality that I have. So I went to work in the med surg unit and I was working that night. And one of the nurses came to get me and she goes, Darren, I know you work in the ICU and I have this patient and he just doesn't seem right. Could you come take a look at him? And I said, absolutely. So I went in the room and I looked at this patient and I said, oh my God, he's having a stroke. So I, you know, immediately called, you know, for a rapid response, got on my phone, called the ICU, called the neurosurgeon. And I said, you know, we need to get this patient down to the CAT scan machine. And it was a teaching hospital. So I had all kinds of residents and we went flying down to the CAT scan machine. I had to make them watch my other patients. And then later that night, you know, guess what? I'm working back in the ICU and I'm taking care of the patient who had crashed in the med surg floor. And I would say that moment, I was like, wow, you know, I think I got this. You know, I recognized it right away. The fact that the other nurse was willing to come to me and ask, you know, my opinion. And it was great because I ended up finishing my shift in the ICU, which was back home where I wanted to be anyway, taking care of a super sick patient that I had played a role in helping them. And I would say that was definitely a moment when I said, I think I got this. And it just felt great, you know?
Yeah. So you spent, I don't know, about 2 years at Carle and then moved on to Rush Oak Park Hospital, where you became the manager of emergency and intensive care services. Again, that's kind of fast to move into management. Now I know a little bit of your background. You've taken on a lot of responsibility, but like, how did that happen?
Well, you know, when I was working at Carle, you know, they also had an opportunity for me. I really wanted to be a flight nurse, goal was to basically fly in the helicopter, and that was going to be the next step in my career. And at Carle, the nursing leaders were very encouraging. And they said, look, Darren, you're impacting two or three patients at a time working in the ICU. You can impact an entire community if you take on a manager job. And while I was at Carle, I was working as a charge nurse, you know, in the ICU, just even after 6 months of being there, I was working charge. And they always would tell me, you know, you should be a nursing leader. You should be a nursing leader. You should be a nursing leader. And I was like, no. And they said, as a nursing leader, you can impact, you know, multiple hundreds of people. Darren, they go, someday you could even impact an entire community. Why would you not want to lead? And I was like, because I'm happy. I love being a nurse. I love working at the bedside. And I kind of went into management kicking and screaming. It was not something I wanted to do. And at that time, you know, my wife and I relocated, you know, from Champaign-Urbana, where she was pursuing a PhD, to back to, you know, the Chicago area. And in going back to the Chicago area, I applied at Rush to work in the ER, and they interviewed me and they said, you know, we have the nursing manager job open. Why don't you take that? And I was like, well, I really don't want to be a manager. Well, next thing you know, I'm the manager. And I started off managing the emergency room and things went extremely well. And I had but it was hard because I never actually worked in the emergency room as a nurse prior to now. I'd worked as a tech in the emergency room and I'd worked in the ICU as a nurse, but I was very blessed and fortunate that there was a gentleman that worked there named Joseph McGinnis. And he was an older nurse and was an amazing guy from Ireland. And he worked in the ER, and he used to be the manager, but he had stepped down several years before to go back to the bedside. So I was blessed to have a mentor in Joseph McGinnis, and he would, as I was trying to lead the ER team as a new young nurse manager, he would frequently come in my office and close the door and sit down, and he'd say, "Hey, we need to have a conversation." I'm like, "Sounds great. You know, what's going on? What are they saying? What did I do wrong? Help me improve." You know, and he was just such a great guide, and we had such a great working relationship. And I would say that's the key to good leadership, is you can never think you've got it figured out. You can never think that you have all the answers. You have to be an extensively good listener and take those cues from people that are willing to share those life lessons and those life leadership moments, so you can use those to improve. Because as leaders, we don't always get it right, and it's hard, you know, to lead. And I was very fortunate to have, you know, Joseph McGinnis there, who really helped me in that first role. And then I was very successful in the nursing vice president there also gave me the ICU. So I was leading both departments and had a great time working at Rush Oak Park.
Wow. So, I mean, and that's still, I mean, you had kind of a, you had some time in the insurance industry and so forth. So you're not like a 24-year-old there, but you,
right.
You're early as a nurse yet, like, and that's pretty impressive. So, I mean, like, what was it like being a clinical leader so early in your career?
It was good. I worked with a lot of nurses, especially at Rush Oak Park, who had been there for years. It was a facility that was blessed with the long standing tenure of a team, and they were amazing people. And, you know, I brought some energy and some different ways of thinking and some different ideas. And I worked with a great medical director, Dan Noonan, who he and I had a wonderful working relationship with. And it was a lot of camaraderie, and everyone really pulled together. And I didn't always see myself as the leader. I tried to see myself as a part of the team. And I would say I learned just as much, if not more, from the people I worked with every day as they learned from me. And I think that's the beauty of healthcare and of leading a team, is that we always have to be about learning and the opportunity for continuous improvement. And if you can create that culture, you know, it's a really great environment where people can really, really excel, and we can take great care of the people we serve in our community.
So you did this role for a couple of years, and then you moved over to Advocate Healthcare, still in Illinois, as the Director of Clinical Products Review. And this takes you, as I, and based on the description I read, completely away from the bedside. What drew you to this role?
Again, I was approached by someone, you know, and when I was working at Rush, who said, "Hey, Darren, I heard about this job that Advocate has, and I think you'd be really, really good at it." And this was actually a sales rep who worked at Rush Oak Park and also covered Advocate. And he approached me and he said, "You really need to talk to them because they have this job, Director of Clinical Products Review." I didn't quite understand what it was. It seemed a little odd to me, but he basically asked if it was okay if he shared my contact information with the people who were hiring for this role. And I said, sure. And I got a call from Mr. John Bruss, who was the vice president of their supply chain operation. And he asked if I could come meet with him. And I did. And he explained to me the opportunity. And as a director of clinical products review at Advocate Healthcare, Advocate was a relatively new system at the time in the Chicago area. You know, they've grown tremendously since then and merged with, you know, with Aurora and Milwaukee, and now with Atrium in the Carolinas. And Advocate was just a very progressive system. But at the time, this was back in 2003, when they were just embarking on a system, this level of approach, which we see very, I mean, that's how the healthcare world is right now. And at the time, we had 8 hospitals. And my job as a nurse was to oversee, working at the corporate office, all of the clinical products that we were using and work on an opportunity to standardize those products. And what it quickly became was way more than that, because every time we would change a product, it would impact patient care, it would impact policy, and there were opportunities for us to improve care. There were opportunities for us to change how we delivered and to basically take the many disparate processes that were in place at 8 hospitals and centralize on what we all deemed to be the best practice. And it started off basically as looking at the 4x4 sponges we buy. And one of the hospitals was paying $2.50 for a pack of 4x4 sponges. Another hospital was paying $1.25. Well, that didn't make any sense. So I would go to the vendor and I would say, look, our lowest price in the system is $1.25. We're one organization, we're one health system, and now our new price is $1.25. We're no longer paying $2.50 for that sponge. We're going to pay the lowest price. And it made no sense to me. Why would Advocate Trinity on the south side of Chicago have to pay $2.50 and Advocate Lutheran General have to pay $1.25 or $1.50? It was amazing to me. So we standardized things like IV pumps across the health system. And then one of the things that really was pivotal in me helping to understand and realize the impact that I could have in this role was we needed to standardize ID bands. So we had a patient ID band. And then they had bands they would put on patients that would indicate things like fall risk, do not resuscitate. And in reviewing the policies at each hospital, one hospital had roughly 16 different color ID bands, and another hospital had four. And at one hospital, a yellow band would mean DNR, and at another hospital, a yellow band would mean fall risk. Mm-hmm. So the nurses worked at the different hospitals. And it wasn't written on the band what it meant. It was just a color. So you had to have that policy in front of you in order to know. So I realized immediately that we had a huge patient safety challenge here. So I presented to our nurse executive council, which is a council where all of the lead nurses at all of the hospitals would meet once a month. And I talked to them about ID band standardization. And I showed them the policy. And I said, before we can standardize on the type of bands we buy, we have to standardize our nomenclature because we have a serious safety issue here. And I showed them a grid that outlined what the different colors were and what they meant at each hospital. And they were in denial. They're like, that is not at all how it is. I'm like, no, I promise you, here's the policies. This is really how we're operating today. And everyone was just flabbergasted. So needless to say, this was a long process because I realized how very, very quickly how passionate people were about their colors and what they meant and how that's always been what our color meant. If you're going to change that, that's a safety issue in and of itself because it's always been that way. And yeah. and that statement means so much about how we operate in healthcare. And so this was an opportunity for me to really change things. So we sat down as a group and we standardized on a color. And then I had to find a vendor that was willing to print those ID bands and also to eliminate the safety risk, write on it what it is, what it means. Is it a fall risk? Is it a DNR? So it had to be printed on there. And I went to various manufacturers and could find no one who could create that product. And I finally found a guy, Choice Products, out of Arizona, who agreed to make these ID bands for us at a really low price. And it worked out. And we made these ID bands. We standardized this process. We standardized the policy. And then we quickly learned we were onto something. So we went to the Illinois Hospital Association and shared our story. And then I was put on a webcast and we started talking about it. And then the whole state of Illinois decided that we needed to standardize the nomenclature, not just across the health system, but across the state. Wow. So that when nurses would go from hospital to hospital, they would know what this color band meant as an alert for the patient. So it was an amazing way to impact care. And that job was very fulfilling. And I ought to tell you, Mark, I never lost my love for the bedside because on the weekends when I worked that job, I would work one or two shifts, you know, every month back in the ICU or back in the ER just to keep my clinical skills up because, you know, I missed taking care of patients.
Yeah. Wow. What a neat story. I mean, just like that. That seems completely intuitive what you were saying. Like this, you know, I would really not want somebody to act like I'm a DNR if I'm actually a fall risk. Like that's kind of terrifying.
Right. You know, it was amazing.
Like we let grandma go because, well, we thought she was DNR, but no, she was actually a fall risk. Ah! So you did this. I mean, that's a neat way to impact. I mean, what a cool impact and a great demonstration of leadership and change management, right? Like that's you must have learned a lot. I mean, what you're describing is kind of the challenges of change management.
Absolutely. And it was an amazing experience. And at the end of the day, everyone got behind it and they realized we could truly make an impact and that it was a challenge. We had to fix it. And then the question was how, you know, and getting there and making sure everyone's voices are heard and that everyone is a part of the process and engaging a lot of stakeholders, keeping people informed about the change. And, you know, it was challenging. You know, you had a lot of policies you had to revise and standardize something across an entire health system. And then to be able to take it across the entire state was just an amazing experience.
Well, that's neat. So you stayed with the Advocate. You did that role for about 4.5 years. You stayed with the Advocate and you went on to return to your, it seems like, kind of true love of director of critical care for the Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center. And was this a significant jump in scale for you in terms of the number of people and operation you were overseeing?
Well, you know, at the time I was kind of identified as someone that Advocate wanted to develop, you know, into a more of a future leader. And after spending, you know, nearly 5 years working at the corporate office, you know, they said, Darren, you know, you have a big, you know, career opportunity here. You've done amazing things. But the question is, can you still lead in operations? You know, so Advocate Illinois Masonic was one of our level one teaching hospitals, level one trauma center in the heart of the city and of Chicago. And they said, you know, we really want you to interview here and help they were going for magnet status and mm-hmm. they wanted me to help support the chief nurse executive there and the other leaders in achieving, you know, magnet accreditation at that site. And it was basically the next career path for me at Advocate. So obviously I jumped at the opportunity to go back to the hospital and lead and leave the corporate office. And I really felt like I'd made the impact I could make there. And it was time to take that next step in my career and show the leadership at Advocate that I could make an impact still at the bedside and leading clinical teams. And so it was a great opportunity to do that. And at the time I was finishing my MBA and it just made sense. So it was a great transition for me.
So moving up to the director level, what did you feel like your leadership growth was? What were you learning? You know, what did you have to learn in order to be successful at that size of an organization?
Yeah. You know, when you make that jump from a nursing manager to a director, you're not as able to be, you know, you're leading the leaders that are leading the people. So it's a little bit of a change in your mindset and how you think. So you really have to adjust to that. And I did, you know, I felt that it went really, really well. And I was thrilled to be able to go back and lead, you know, from an operations perspective and see the team and the people and work alongside the leaders. But as a director, you're not necessarily, again, you're leading the people that are doing the leading of the bedside nurses. So you have to begin to adopt a little bit of a different strategic mindset and you have to pull on your skills that you learned as a nursing manager to help mentor and help other young leaders to be able to learn and inspire them and impart some of those leadership lessons that you would learn, whether it be medical staff relations, you know, working with human resources on developing our people. And so it is a big stretch, but it's one that you just have to adapt to because your role is just slightly different than what it was before.
So you did this for a couple of years, and then you make a pretty significant jump. You leave in 2009. You leave Illinois and Chicago, and go to be the director of the emergency department at HCA Florida Orange Park Hospital. So you down in Florida, and at this point you're managing an ED, which seems to be right in your wheelhouse. What made you decide to leave the Midwest and head to the Jacksonville area? That's a pretty significant change.
It is. You're absolutely right. And I loved working at Advocate, and I probably would have never left Advocate Healthcare. But, you know, as all things happen, I mean, you have your professional life and you have your personal life. And this is where it's kind of a personal story. But when I had started working at Advocate, my wife and I unfortunately went through a bit of a divorce. So our marriage ended. We had two young children and we split time, you know, caring for them. I was fortunate enough to, when I was living at Illinois Masonic in Chicago, that she was working for Harold Washington College there in Chicago, and we were able to care for our children. We lived a few blocks from each other. But I got one of those Monday morning emails that said, you know, my ex-wife had found a job at Jacksonville University in Jacksonville, Florida, and she was going to move there, and her parents were going, and her fiance was going, and I could see the kids on, you know, summers and holidays. And I said, well, you know, I really want to be a part of my kids' life, and I want to be with them. And I didn't want to battle that decision. I knew as a nurse I could find a job somewhere. So I decided to follow her to Jacksonville, Florida. Now, the biggest challenge of this is it's, if you remember what was going on in 2008, 2009, when I made that transition, the economy was falling apart. Yeah. Life as we knew it was very challenging. It was hard to find a job because no one was hiring. And fortunately for me, HCA had a job as a director of the emergency room, and it was the only job I could get. And I jumped at the chance to be able to go to Florida and be with my kids and be a part of their lives and raise them and keep working. So I took a substantial pay cut from what I was doing at Advocate and decided to reinvent my life in Florida.
Wow. Well, that reflects your values. I think that's a pretty cool decision. HCA is a for-profit system. So you had been working in non-for-profit systems in the past. What was it like transitioning to a for-profit system? And what did you learn working in a for-profit system that you've been able to take forward?
I would say working in a for-profit system, you know, HCA is a very, very mission-driven organization. They have playbooks, you know, that create the processes for how things should be done. They're very methodical. They're very organized. They really know how to run hospitals. And it was a great experience to learn the differences between the non-for-profit and the for-profit sector. And I really learned the power of due diligence and following the processes that are laid out. And Advocate is very structured. There's a roadmap. There's a guide. I'm sorry, HCA was very structured. There's a roadmap, a guide for how you do things, you know, and you follow that roadmap as a leader. They're also big on accountability. You know, you're going to hit your budget. You're going to hit your quality metrics, and you're going to be successful at that. So it was definitely a little bit more of a high pressure environment, because to work at HCA, you know, you have to hit your numbers. That's mm-hmm. that's part of what's required.
Okay. So you were with them for almost 4 years, and I was kind of, and you made your next jump, which was to over to the Baptist system. And I kind of, because I don't know the geography down there, I did a Google map to see how far did you have to go? And it was like, they basically went up the street. So I saw, so your next move was to the Baptist Health System, and you stayed with Baptist for about 11 years in progressive growth positions. Again, mostly kind of around your specialty of emergency services, ultimately rising to be the vice president for the system's ambulatory campuses and emergency services before becoming president of Baptist Medical Center in Clay. I wanted to kind of fast forward through this portion a bit, but like, what would you say in those 11 years as you move through the system appointment as the president of Baptist Medical Center? What were the most important turning points in your career that kind of prepared you to become a hospital president?
Well, I was very fortunate that I was working at HCA one day and my phone rang and it was a number I didn't recognize. And I let it go to voicemail. When I listened to it, it was, Dr. Diane Raines, who was the nurse executive for Baptist Health, called and asked how I was doing and would I be willing to have coffee with her. And I said, of course. So she and I had coffee and we had a great meeting. And 2 weeks later, I got a call from her and she wanted me to meet the chief operating officer and one of the hospital presidents, which I did. And it was 6 months and 24 interviews. I kid you not. Yeah, 24 interviews with Baptist, because they were embarking on a new strategy and they wanted to open their first freestanding emergency department. And they felt that I could help them achieve that goal. So that was what I was. I was hired to open the freestanding emergency department at Baptist Clay Medical Campus. And my job was to build relationships in that county, which is where, you know, the HCE hospital was located. And Florida at the time had a certificate of need process. So my job was to develop that campus, develop that freestanding ED, build relationships with the medical staff, and eventually become the hospital president of that location. So in the course of doing that, and the certificate of need process being what it was at that time in the state of Florida, we were denied. And during all of that work, I again worked as a system leader, much like I did at Advocate, standardizing processes and policies. And these were largely based around how we function in our emergency rooms. Because one of the requests from Mr. Hugh Green, who was the president of Baptist at that time, when they hired me, was he said, look, himself and you know, and John Wilbanks, who was the chief operating officer, they said, Darren, we want our consumers to walk into any Baptist Health emergency room and feel like they've walked into a Baptist Health emergency room. Right now, they're very disparate. They're very different. Their practices are varied. They have an 8% left without being seen rate. Our patient satisfaction is not what we want it to be. We know we're better than this. We know we can achieve this. So I partnered with the emergency department medical staff leadership and with leadership across the entire organization, and would visit each of their hospital-based emergency rooms, you know, while I was building the Baptist Clay freestanding ED, and work on the standardization of processes, such as things like immediate bedding, making sure that the hospitals understand that, you know, patients holding in the emergency room is not an emergency room problem, it's a hospital problem. We all have to work together on that patient throughput. And basically standardized how all of the emergency rooms function, including a giant, you know, children's hospital that was part of our system. And at Baptist Clay, built the first combined, you know, hospital ER that was also dedicated to peds, with the branding of the Wolfson's Children's Hospital associated with it, which is something we hadn't been successful in doing before. And we had such success with that hospital that, you know, we wanted to open a few more of these freestanding EDs. And I would literally drive around town. I would look for land that was available. I would look for the most highly trafficked areas. And I had the opportunity to hand pick, you know, the sites that I felt we needed to buy to build these. And we built one at the town center. It took a lot of convincing to convince the board and my CEO and my COO that this was the right location, because it was in the middle of a huge shopping district right off the highway. And I was like, no, it's the world's best location for this hospital, and explained why. And I remember getting in the car with my COO and we drove around various sites, and I ended our journey at that location, made him get out of the car. And we stood by the for sale sign that said this land was for sale. And I said, now count the cars, you know, that drove by. And it was just amazing exposure. And I said, and then I pulled the demographics of the community and how young the population was there, and then sold this idea to our board and to the other health system leaders. And we built this emergency room, and it was extremely successful. And then we built one on the north side. We built one on the west side. And all this time I'm building these freestanding EDs, but I'm still working at Clay, working on the certificate of need, which got denied again because we kept getting fought, and the battle was raging on about whether or not Baptist really needed a hospital in Clay County. And the whole time I'm living in Clay County, and the Clay County people are telling me, we only have one option for care. We need a hospital in Clay. Can Baptist please build a hospital? When are you going to build a hospital? When are you going to build a hospital? And the community really wanted this hospital because they wanted more choice. There were lots of unmet needs. And then eventually, fast forward, July 1st of 2019, certificate of need gets outlawed in the Florida legislature. Oh, wow. And we knew this was going to happen. I was listening on, you know, to the radio as the Florida House and Senate passed the bills. And we immediately went to work on designing and building the hospital in Clay that we promised the people of Clay County we would bring them.
Could you talk to just very briefly, what's a certificate of need policy?
Wow. You know, certificate of need is where state regulators, you know, in healthcare will, and there's several states that still have certificate of need, many states that have abolished certificate of need, and you know, certificate of need controls access, because the rule or the thinking was, when certificate of needs really started to become a thing way back in the 70s, was because hospitals and health systems would build hospitals only in areas where, you know, there was a population that was more or less deemed to be highly compensated. They didn't want to build hospitals in poor neighborhoods. So there felt that there needed to be controls over that process. So that's why Certificate of Need was put in place, was to prevent hospitals from only building hospitals in, you know, in areas where there was a opportunity for to serve a population that basically was more capable of paying their bills, for lack of a better way of putting it. And then the states began to regulate where you could and could not build hospitals. Mm-hmm. And there's many schools of thought around that. Many people support it and think it's a good cost control mechanism to keep down the costs in healthcare. And others feel that it denies access. And I can sit here beyond the shadow of a doubt and tell you, in Clay County, Florida, it denied people access. Because they there was only so many people that the HCA hospital could serve. And the HCA hospital, when I was there, went from 196 beds to 400, you know, trying to serve that population. But bigger isn't always better, because people still had to drive 30, 45 minutes to receive that care. And that's hard.
Yeah, yeah. So, so you successfully built that hospital and you took over leadership of the hospital in March of 2020. That's fortuitous timing.
Yeah, you know, it was amazing. They named me the hospital president. We had the plans to the hospital set up. We had hired the, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. We had hired the construction company that was going to build the hospital. They brought in the construction trailers. I'm not kidding you. The bulldozers rolled in. And we began clearing land. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and we were on our way. 11 o'clock that morning, I get a call from our CEO and our CFO, and they said, we're shutting it down.
Oh, no.
This COVID thing is wild. We don't know what's going to happen next. We can't spend this money. And we don't, I mean, the sky is falling, right? That's how it was. Everything was starting to shut down. And we literally, 3 hours later, loaded those bulldozers on a truck, and I watched them drive away.
After years of work.
After years of work. And I'm not going to lie. No. At that moment, I collapsed on the floor of my office. I cried. I prayed. Yeah. And I said, God, when am I ever going to have the chance to bring the people of Clay County, Florida, a hospital? I can't imagine how many barriers we've had to overcome to make this happen. And now I have this thing called COVID. You've got to be kidding me. You know, it was just an amazing, surreal experience. And so I refocused my energy. You know, I had all those emergency rooms to run. We didn't know what was going to happen. I put on scrubs. And I went back to the bedside and I started triaging in our ERs when people were coming in, and I started leading my teams in the best way I knew how, because we had to get through this.
Yeah. So when did the hospital get built then? How long were you delayed?
We were delayed until the end of October. And at the end of October of 2020, we had a very silent groundbreaking. We realized very quickly that we were going to need even more beds.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That delaying that project was a huge mistake. But again, we didn't know what we didn't know. And we set out to build a hospital in the middle of COVID, which then we encountered supply chain delays and just barrier after barrier in trying to build a hospital in the middle of a pandemic. But we were about that work and we had to get it done.
Wow. And so simultaneous with this, you're still managing all those EDs. That must have been, like, as COVID hit, that must have been incredible. Like,
it was an incredible
in all
time,
the bad ways.
Every day, the rule book changed every day. Yeah. We were learning new things. And it was, you know, I was in my car running all over the city of Jacksonville, trying to support my teams, trying to help lead. And at the same time, you know, we were all scared. It was challenging times for all of us. And we kept getting waves of patients through these various pandemics, and keeping a team motivated and leading through COVID was one of the most challenging things I've ever had to do in my career, beyond the shadow of a doubt. It was really, really hard.
What would you say are the leadership lessons that you, reflecting back on those several years, in particular with COVID, like, what did you, how did it change your leadership? What did you learn? What are you taking forward from that? I mean, it's not that far back in our history.
You know,
at this point.
The hard part is, you know, managing a team and helping us focus on the work of taking care of people every day, because even though things were changing, we still had these patients that needed us that we had to care for. And we not only had our COVID patients, we had all the other people that had the regular things in life, you know, that happened to you. And I saw very quickly, you know, the impact it would have on our team, the impact it was having on our patients as we were locked down and not able to have visitors. And it was just a really challenging time. And we questioned everything, you know, we wondered about everything, and there were no answers and no clear playbooks on how to get things done. And I learned something very important about medicine is all through nursing school, you know, we're taught how to take care of various diseases. That's what you learn. You learn pathophysiology. You learn about how to care for a patient with diabetes. You write care plans on how to take care of a patient with congestive heart failure. And here we are as a medical community tackling something we'd never heard of before, that no one had ever experienced. And there were all these novel treatments and things being done every day. And trying to lead through that is very challenging, because we've always had a recipe on how we care for certain disease processes or injuries. And now we didn't have one, and we had to create that. And that was tough. And then it became political, and then that made it even harder. And that was probably the worst thing that could have happened during COVID, was the political impacts of that and how that impacted our teams, our patients, and the caregivers who had to deliver care through those times.
Yeah. When did you open the doors of the hospital finally?
We opened the doors of the hospital in December of 2022.
That's a
pretty
quick
build. And it was an amazing day.
Yeah, that's a pretty quick build, especially given all the challenges you had going on.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
How did
it feel? I remember the team. I recruited the medical staff, and we were going to build something that was going to be a great gift to the folks of Clay County.
Yeah. How did it feel when you were able to open the doors and have the first patients?
You know, it was hard, because you know, there were a lot of barriers to overcome in building a hospital in the middle of COVID, and a lot of inspections you have to go through in the state of Florida. And it was Friday, just a couple days before we were ready to open. And we had our last inspection that Thursday night, and we were waiting all day on Friday for the license, you know, from, you know, Tallahassee, Florida, which is the capital. And I was on the phone with my legal team all day trying to see if we were going to get this license, because my boss had told me, hey, if you don't have that license tonight, there's no way we're opening Monday morning. You know, you're going to have to figure something else out. And there's a lot riding on that. It's a lot of pressure. Leading up to it, you know, we had moved that date several times based on the challenges with construction. We had already held the grand opening because we knew it was getting close. And it was just a matter of, when are you going to be able to actually open those doors and take your first patient? And there's no words that can ever explain, you know, that level of stress. And having this whole team here that's been training, I mean, it's an immense amount of cost. It's a huge burden. And you have all these people whose lives are dependent on you opening this hospital, because you've recruited people who have come from other hospitals, and you're recruiting them on just your vision of what this is going to be like. They have no idea. They can't come and tour their unit and see where they're going to be working when they take this new job. So it's the most, it is so challenging as a leader. There are no words to describe it, because you literally have to create and paint the vision. And then you have to make it what you said it was going to be, because that's so important. You have to be about your word if you're going to lead people. So that night, Friday night at 5:20, I got a call from our legal department, and they said, the license is on the way. Check your email. And when I opened my email and got that license, I screamed. I was just so happy and ecstatic. I was like, we finally did it, you know? I called my wife. We went out for a great dinner. We had a bottle of wine. We celebrated. Then I rested all weekend, because I knew Monday was going to be the day. And, yeah, you know, we went to work, and it was amazing. And we started admitting people. Our first patient was admitted that morning by 7:30, because we already had the emergency room. Instead of putting him in an ambulance and sending him somewhere else, you know, we literally now just brought him upstairs.
Yeah.
So it was great stuff.
Wow. What a neat thing. Interesting. So you opened in December of 22. So not too long after that, you made the decision to come up this way to and you. So this past summer, you came to Wentworth Douglas Hospital, which is in Dover, one town away from UNH. So it's kind of our hometown hospital to be the new president. So what made you decide to come to New Hampshire? That's pretty different than lovely Florida and your home of Illinois. Like, what brought you up this way?
You know, I opened the hospital, and it was one of the greatest experiences. The hospital very quickly, you know, filled up. Within 3 months, became the leader in maternity there in the hospital. We delivered more babies than any other hospital in that region. With our first 3 months of opening, we became, you know, we were voted best hospital in the county. We were voted best place to work. So what I had built was extremely successful, and I had a lot to be proud of. And me and my wife talked about this, and we said, you know, I can stay here and I can continue to run this thing that I've put my heart and soul in for the past 11 years, or, you know, I can go on and try something else. And, you know, I never really wanted to live in Florida, which is a weird thing to say. I kind of went there by,
yeah,
you know, to be with my kids.
With your kids, yeah.
I had remarried and found a beautiful wife in Florida who supported me and was a fabulous woman. And now my kids were the two I had, you know, came there to raise, were now in college and had lives of their own. And I missed the seasons. You know, Florida is just so hot and humid. And having been raised in the Midwest, I yearned for fall. You know, yearned for snow. And I know that sounds crazy, but I really felt like it was time for a change. So my wife said, and I felt like I had made my impact at Baptist. I felt like I had done what I was brought there to do. And I know that sounds crazy, but I felt like I need to turn this over to someone else who's going to have some new ideas, you know, who can take it to the next level, because I've really maximized my amount of creativity and the impact I felt I could have. And I know that sounds weird, but I really felt that in my heart. So it was a tough decision. And my wife said, well, you know, apply for a couple jobs and see what happens, you know. And she would send in me jobs, and she sent me the one for Masjid Brigham here at Wentworth Douglas. And I said, well, I'll apply for that. And she said, sounds great. And I applied for several others. And I was very fortunate and blessed to get, you know, a lot of interviews, which I was floored. I didn't think anyone would want me. So I was interviewing with several different hospitals and health systems, and got called in for final interviews here at Wentworth Douglas with the Masjid Brigham team. And I fell in love with New Hampshire. I fell in love with the beauty. I fell in love with the team. And I said, this is just an amazing place. And it just really felt right. Everyone I met was just amazing. The board here was amazing and supportive. And I went back home, and after the interviews, and my wife and I talked, and I told her, I says, you know, I have a lot of other irons in the fire right now. I had an opportunity to go interview with the health system out west, and I was in the final stages of that interview process. And I told her, I says, none of that feels though as good as this opportunity. Hmm. And we both sat there one night after some soul searching, and I said, look, if things don't work out with Masjid Brigham, then I'm going to stay here at Baptist, because that's where I'm supposed to be. I really feel that. And if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. So I called the hospital system out west, and I said, thank you for the opportunity, but I just don't feel it's going to be the right fit. And I had another opportunity in the Midwest, and that just didn't feel, you know, like coming back home in the Midwest was what I was supposed to do. And a couple of weeks went by, and I got a call from Masjid Brigham, and they said, we want you to lead Wentworth Douglas. And I was like, wow, you've got to be kidding. And it was just a great moment, and called my wife and said, guess what? We're going to New Hampshire.
We're going to New Hampshire. Now, your wife's a Florida girl?
My wife is a Florida girl, yeah.
Well, at least it's been a mild winter.
It has been a very mild winter. It was a good way to introduce her to the snow, and we've had some great opportunities to explore together, and I'm teaching her how to be a cold weather girl. Right. The things we all take for granted when we're raised in cold weather are just amazing. Yeah. The things that she's learned, it cracks me up. Like, you know, don't wear your slickest shoes when it's snowing outside. You want to wear those ones with the grip that I took you up to the Kittery Outlet and bought you, you know, knowing what was going to be coming because she didn't know how to stitch a winter gear. So this has been fun.
Well, that's great. I hope she likes it.
She loves
Shakespeare, the whole thing. So tell us a little bit, tell us for the folks who are not familiar with Wentworth Douglas and MGB, kind of what is special about Wentworth Douglas?
You know, Wentworth Douglas is a very special 178-bed community hospital that really is the epitome of a community hospital. It's been here for well over 100 years here in Dover, and we take great care of the community every single day. And the community has such a love of this hospital. They embrace it. They see it as their hospital. It's great to work here and see all that, you know, Wentworth does to give back to the community. And it really is the fabric of a community. And if there's one thing I've learned, especially, you know, in my experience in Florida, is that the impact that a hospital can have on a community and how healthcare, good quality healthcare, is so important to the quality of living to the folks that call that community home, whether it be Dover or whether it be Clay County, Florida. Access to care is just so important to the quality of life. And that is something that Wentworth brings to Dover and the Seacoast community in such a big way. And I'm very blessed and fortunate to have the opportunity to lead now and build upon the great reputation that the community has and that Wentworth has here in the community, and the trust and the faith. And I love getting out in the community and talking and meeting folks, whether it be presenting to a Rotary or a retirement community, and hearing folks' feedback about Wentworth and how we can continue to serve them and the things we need to do to, can, as I said before, continuously improve and earn the right to be their hospital of choice every single day. And that's our mission. We want to be Dover, the Seacoast's number one community hospital.
So up until relatively recently, Wentworth Douglas was an independent entity. It was an independent hospital. The board made the decision to affiliate, basically merge with the Mass General Brigham system. So in the time I've been here, so I came to UNH in 2015, the vast majority of hospitals in the state, which there aren't that many, there's only 26, but they were mostly independent. Today, that's the opposite is true. Most of them have now affiliated in one way or another. Why? So kind of maybe thinking about Wentworth Douglas as an example, like both specifically, but also as kind of an indication of a broader trend. Why did Wentworth Douglas decide it needed to be part of MGB? And kind of why is this happening more broadly in the healthcare system from your perspective?
You know, healthcare is a very expensive endeavor, and running a hospital, you know, and a hospital itself, it's a very, you know, capital heavy investment. You know, hospitals have to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's extensive, you know, 365, right? We have to always have generators for power. It's like a little city inside of a bigger city. You know, we have our own cafeteria, we create our own food, we have our pharmacy. It's a self-sustaining organism in a community, and it's a very, very expensive endeavor. Hospitals are extremely expensive to run because of building codes, and you know, anytime we touch anything to remodel it, it's extensively expensive because we have to meet certain codes that other facilities just don't have to meet. That, coupled with the fact that people really don't want to pay more for healthcare, there's been a lot of pressure on healthcare systems to reduce costs and on hospitals to reduce costs. We've seen that with people's benefit costs going up, their co-pays going up. So there's a lot of pressure to rein in costs in healthcare. And through this process of trying to rein in costs, it's become very expensive and nearly impossible for a standalone hospital to survive and have the negotiating power to negotiate with the payers for better rates, to negotiate with suppliers for better priced medical supplies, because everything's all about the volume. What kind of volume do you produce? You know, it's the laws of supply and demand. And it's hard to recruit staff because, you know, you have, you know, you're not able to go out on the market and even buy your own benefit plan for your employees at a reduced rate because you're just so small. So it's all those cost containment pressures that force hospitals into needing to merge with a bigger organization to be able to have better purchasing power, to be able to basically have the survival of the numbers. And in a lot of times, those health systems will help support your mission and fund your losses, because you're taking the aggregate of multiple health systems and you're distributing those losses and gains across the entire enterprise so that everyone can survive together. And that's really the key of being a part of a bigger health system.
And what do you see as like the kind of the logic of consolidation? Like where like Mass General Brigham is a very large system. So setting aside like government antitrust stuff, right? Like where they're, you know, either the state or the federal government is going to say, hey, no. Like, what are the pressures? Like, how far does this go? Where do we stop getting efficiencies of scale, you think?
Yeah, one of the things with working is with a health system is when you're an independent hospital, you have one perspective, one viewpoint. When you're working with a health system, you have multiple viewpoints. You have relationships with others across that health system. And one of the things I explained to the Wentworth Douglas team all day is, you know, an emergency room leader, you know, speaks emergency room. An OR leader speaks operating room. A lab leader speaks lab. And when you're in an independent hospital, we all together, we speak Wentworth Douglas. That's our common language. But when it comes to sharing best practices from the lab, the OR, the emergency room, we just have each other. We just have ourselves, really. When you're part of a health system, you can interact with other leaders who, guess what? They speak lab. They speak OR, and you suddenly find out that there's all these other people who do the same job as you, who have great ideas that you can share. And it's that cross-pollination of ideas that lead to best practices, that leads to cost savings, that leads to synergy, it's the ability to share staff and resources across the organization that really benefits everyone. And I saw that at Advocate. I certainly saw it at Baptist, and definitely see it here with one Mass Gen Brigham.
Yeah. Okay. So, there are clearly benefits to being part of a system with anchor hospitals like Mass Gen and Brigham, which are incredible academic. I mean, they're world-class academic medical centers. What do they bring? What does having that kind of affiliation? So as opposed to maybe, you know, having a bunch of similar community hospitals, you actually have sort of a hierarchy of, if you will, of care, but also research. And how does Wentworth Douglas, how does Dover benefit from being part of the Mass Gen system?
How we benefit is we're able to, thank you. No, we're able to bring a lot of those resources closer to home here in Dover for patients that are available at the academic medical centers. One example is we've really expanded our pediatric care and complex care for children. You know, we have specialists that come up from Boston and actually deliver care in our clinics here in the hospital, you know, which is the Mass Gen, you know, for children. And they're located right here, you know, at Wentworth Douglas now. And those parents no longer have to drive for those appointments all the way down to Boston. Another good example is cancer care. You know, we've really been able to advance cancer care here in the Seacoast by having, you know, the cancer care experts from Mass Gen available right here in our community. Cardiology is another great example where we've really been able to expand care and have cardiac specialists that are available now at Wentworth, so patients don't have to drive to Boston for certain care or procedures or to see a certain specialist. And I could just keep going on and on and on. But the beauty of that is that we're able to keep more patients here in the community, which is kind of the opposite of what you would think. Most folks tell me, well, didn't you guys get acquired so you could send more people to Boston? No, it's the exact opposite. The Boston providers are coming here so that we can keep our patients here. It's right care, right place, right time in our community. And that's what we're able to do, which is amazing. Now, it doesn't work out all the time. There's still those special procedures that you may need to go to Boston for, but we're definitely doing everything we can to keep folks closer to home so they don't have to leave the Seacoast area to receive care.
So there's a lot of challenges, broadly speaking, in healthcare now. I mean, too many to address in a couple of minutes. But like, I'm thinking about telehealth. MGB's been pioneering hospital at home, AI. Like, what do you think? What's the most exciting stuff happening in healthcare innovation right now, from your perspective?
You know, AI is certainly exciting. You know, we're seeing a lot of changes in how patients are diagnosed with AI and the new technology. Hospital at home is something that we're very, confident can help keep patients out of the hospital who don't need to necessarily be admitted for those low acuity conditions. So hopefully we'll be able to bring that hospital at home from Mass to New Hampshire in the coming, months to a year or so. And that's certainly something we're going to be working hard on. But I think AI will alter the landscape of how our patients receive their diagnosis. And a lot of work is being done in that. Mass General Brigham is one of the leading edge, research institutions that is leading the pack in terms of some of that AI development. And we just have to make sure that it's done in the right way, that it provides the patient benefit that we're hoping for, and we do it safely. And as with anything in healthcare, it's highly regulated. So I still think, there's several years to come before we see a lot of these innovations be front-facing and patient-centered, because we, with anything, you want to roll it out in the safest possible way so that impacts the most amount of people without any negative consequences. But the world is definitely changing. It's changed dramatically from the time, I embarked on my healthcare career. We were still paper charting and I was signing my name. And now I don't even think anyone brings a pen to work because everything is, electronic. We document electronically. And so it's exciting to see what the next 10 to 15 years will hold. But I definitely think that the way patients receive care and the way they're diagnosed is that world will be altered.
Yeah. Well, I want to close on a little bit about leadership and some of your perspectives. And so I'm going to quote from your LinkedIn profile. You say, "I am a healthcare executive that loves to inspire others. I drive exceptional operational and financial performance through a personal presence that is characterized by a sense of honesty, integrity, and caring, with the ability to inspire and motivate the employees and physicians I work with." So I like that opening. Can you explain some of the secrets behind your ability to drive exceptional performance?
I would say I ask our clinical teams to do one thing every single day, and that is to take care of everyone, every patient, like their mom, aunt, uncle, sister, brother, mother, because they are, someone's mom, aunt, uncle, sister, brother, mother. And I think that if we as an organization just focus on patients first and do everything in our power to deliver the best in care and quality outcomes and are always looking for ways to continuously improve, then, we're going to be the hospital of choice. And if you entered healthcare and chose to work in this profession, you spent a lot of time going to school to learn your certification, to learn your specialty, whether you're an ultrasound technician or a physician or a nurse at the bedside. And you did this because in your heart, you really wanted to be able to care for people. So my job as a leader in healthcare is to give people the freedom to do that to the best of their abilities, to fix the processes, remove the barriers, and then work on consistency and accountability in the workplace so that every day when caregivers come to work, they know what to expect and they know how to deliver that care. And I, as a leader, am that umbrella that kind of shields them from the noise of the world, from the worries about how we're going to pay our bills, to the worries about where we're going to find the staff, and all those things that we as leaders have to worry about, so that our team members every day can just come to work and focus on the art and science of care delivery and the compassion that comes with that, and knowing that we're all going to be patients someday. And we all need, when we're having that weak moment and our lives have been interrupted by illness or injury, having that caring person there is the most important thing that we can do as caregivers. And giving our teams the freedom to do that. And that's my ask. And I think it works successfully because that's why people enter the world of healthcare, is to be able to make that difference in care for the members of their community.
So something else I noticed in reading over your profile is you pretty consistently include this phrasing, and I don't know if it was just kind of throwaway or if you're, typing quickly or whatever, but it seems important to you because you say it in multiple roles. And what you tend to say, accountable for strategic planning, business development, market share growth, and operational insight. And then you kind of go on to talk about whatever the particular thing is you're managing at the time. Is this kind of what you see as the core function of leadership? Is that why it's there in most of your, the way you describe your roles?
I would say it really is. And it's what I've been responsible for throughout my career. You know, I've always had the opportunity to do that. And it's always been the mantra and the drive and the push is to, you know, to have that strategic mindset, to be thinking about the future, to be planning for the future, and to be thinking about how we continuously evolve to care for our patients and serve them. We've seen a lot of changes in healthcare and the way we care for patients. Hip patient, you know, if you had a hip replacement surgery when I graduated nursing school, you were in the hospital for 5 or 6 days. Those patients go home same day now. Yeah. So, you know, we always have to be preparing for that next innovation and that next challenge that's going to alter the way we care for patients so that we can lead and prepare our teams for those changes so that we can keep abreast. And by doing that, we're better serving our communities because we're able to give our patients the latest and greatest opportunities at a cure or in helping to restore healing. And the only way we do that is by constantly being aware and taking on those new challenges and preparing our teams for the future.
I just found it interesting. You mentioned business development and market share growth pretty consistently. And I don't know that I've seen other healthcare executives talk about that quite as consistently as you seem to. What does that mean in your thinking, like as a rising leader? If I'm thinking about, all right, I want to do like Darren did, how did that kind of understanding of, you know, focus on like business development but I'm not yet a president of a hospital.
Business development is really about, you know, what are the services the community needs and how do we meet them? Rather it be, do we need to build another surgery center? Do we need a freestanding ED? Do we need another primary care office at X location? So that's really what business development is all about. It's about identifying the needs of your community and the best way that we can meet those needs. And then the market share growth, you know, if you're not, you have to grow to survive, you know, in this current economy. And it's challenging to grow. But, you know, one of the takeaways from, you know, from this year's, you know, conference that, you know, was held out in San Francisco, and the name of that conference is escaping me, but growth is an imperative right now in healthcare if you can grow, because you have to grow, you know, to survive. That's just the reality of it. And if we're not capable of growing and capturing market share, then you know, we're not going to be able to survive. And with the many financial challenges that are impacting health systems today. So that's why market share growth is so essential. And as a new leader, you know, who wants to embark upon a career in healthcare and find your place, you know, you have to always be thinking about what are those opportunities for growth. You know, I've been kind of blessed with a knack to drive through a community and see what the healthcare resources are. And then, you know, look and say, you know, it would be really great if we had a primary care here, because there doesn't seem to be any primary care in this region, or this is missing, or you know, patients need access to outpatient imaging. Where is that located? Do they have to drive to the mothership, the main hospital, all the time from 20 miles away? So that's the kind of thinking that you have to have, because you should always be focused on the consumer of healthcare and making it convenient. Because if there's one thing we've learned, and I'm a victim of this myself as not only a healthcare leader, but a healthcare consumer, is if it's not convenient, I may skip that test. I may skip colonoscopy that I need to do, even though I know it's time. And we don't want people to miss out on the opportunity to get that preventative care. So we as healthcare leaders have to make it easy for the consumer to access our services, so that we can maintain health continuity and promote, you know, quality of healthcare in the communities in which we live and serve.
So I'm trying to get a little bit at your leadership style and philosophy. I think this sounds like it's an important part, but could you summarize what your leadership philosophy is?
Yeah, my leadership philosophy is really, you know, I try to lead by example. You know, I don't ask anyone to do a job that I haven't done already in healthcare. There's nothing that I won't do. I'm very blessed and fortunate to have the clinical background and have worked in the clinical setting for many years. And so I know and understand, you know, what it's like to be at the bedside delivering care and the challenges that come from that sometimes, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning when you feel like there's no one else around and you have the sickest patient you could ever imagine caring for. So I always keep that in the back of my mind and try to put myself in the shoes of my employees and try to identify how I can best serve them as a leader and give them the tools and the resources they need to be successful. And then it comes back to kind of what I said before. I think we as leaders, you know, have to understand the processes that get in the way of our team members delivering care. We have to remove the barriers that develop, you know, in the process of care delivery. And then in exchange for that, we just want there to be a consistent process and to be accountable to the people we serve to make sure that we're meeting their needs in the best way possible with quality care and outcomes that you would expect for your loved one or a member of your family. And one thing I always say is people come to the hospital because they have an illness or an injury. It's our job to make sure we make them better. And we have to be methodical about that because, you know, the care that we deliver can come with complications sometimes. We don't want folks to walk away with an infection from a urinary catheter or a central line. You know, these are the things we need to deliver care, but we have to do that safely. And we want to make sure that we deliver the best possible care and outcomes to those patients. So we restore healing and send them back to their family and their community restored and ready to live their best life.
Something I heard as you've been talking throughout our conversation was, you've talked a lot about mentors, and it just seems like, and you're very humble about the opportunities you've been presented. But I mean, just like going back to your time in the mailroom and the CEO walks in and is like, this is your last day. And you're probably like, oh my God, I'm going to be fired. But then he pulls you up to, you know, instead to a new role. You had this sales rep who kind of picked you out and moved you over, you know, got you on your road to advocate to the, I think you said CNO, a Baptist, and your 24 interviews. But it seems like people have kind of picked you out. And clearly it's at least partially because of great performance, of course. But one of the things I talk to, so, you know, I teach primarily undergraduate health administration program. And one of the things I try to explain to my students is, you know, being a great performer is not enough. Like, you've got to kind of find a way to have people see you, to be open to opportunities so that people think of you when they are aware of an opportunity and they connect you to that opportunity. It seems like in a lot of parts of your career, you haven't been looking for the thing. The thing has come to you. So what advice would you be able to give to a young person going into their career, healthcare or otherwise, such that people will think of them when there's an opportunity?
You know, that's a great question, Mark. And I've thought about that myself multiple times throughout my life, because I have been very, very fortunate and very blessed to have people who have identified me. And as I've said in talking, you know, really believe more in me than I ever believed in myself. And, you know, life is sometimes so by chance and happenstance, and you can't predict what each day is going to bring. And so it's a hard question to answer, but I would say it's not just about the hard work, but it's also about being available and being a good listener and being approachable and being someone who's open to new ideas and never says no. And you have to present, I guess, in my mind, if there's one thing that I would say has helped me to be that person, is just a little bit of a curious mindset. I've always been just a little bit curious about things, and I've always been a question asker. And I think that people have seen that in me, and they said, hey, this guy actually cares. He's very inquisitive. He wants to know the why. And I think that's been a piece of that recipe that's helped me to be successful, I think. I mean, I really don't – it's hard for me to know, but I think that certainly has played a role, because I've always been one that doesn't hesitate to ask the why and wants to learn, and constantly am learning, because I know that I only know what I know, and I don't know what I don't. And so I have to learn every day. And I think that's been part of it. And that's what I would encourage your students to do, is never lose that learning mindset that they have right now, because life is about continuous learning. And as I've said many times, it's about continuous improvement. And you can't improve if you're not learning. So you have to be inquisitive. You have to be willing to ask the questions, and be that methodical thinker. And then the willingness, when people do say, well, I don't know the answer, but why don't you figure it out? To go figure it out.
Darren, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a lot of fun hearing your story, and I'm glad you're here in our community.
Thank you, Mark. I'm thrilled to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to let me share with your students.
You've been listening to the Health Leader Forge. Please go to our website, healthleaderforge.org, for more information or to leave comments about today's podcast. Look for Health Leader Forge podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and other podcast distribution sites. Thanks for being a part of the Health Leader Forge community, and we'll talk with you again soon.